Welcome to the Hashtag MoLedge podcast broadcast from the state capitol in Jefferson City, sponsored by the St. Louis Regional Chamber of Commerce, Missouri Farm Bureau, and the Sheet Metal Workers Local 36. Now from the state capitol, the Hashtag MoLedge podcast.
This is Rachel Dunn, managing editor of the Missouri Times, and we're back with a special veto session, election edition of the Hashtag MoLeg podcast. First off, a big thank you to our sponsors, St. Louis Regional Chamber of Commerce and the Carpenters Union. Today, we're at the Downtown Diner in Jefferson City with Callaway County State Rep Travis Fitzwater and lobbyist Jay Atkins. First off, we're going to talk about veto session. The current partisan composition going into Wednesday is 114 Republicans, 45 Democrats, one independent, and four vacancies. So one bill that's likely to come up, gentlemen, is the gun bill, SB 656.
Never heard of it.
I've heard that there's even going to be some television advertisements in some key districts where some legislators might be swing votes, but I've heard there's a solid 115 votes. Is there any risk of this bill not being overridden? What do you think, Representative?
I think an important piece to it is the one of the candidates running for statewide office, who's a Democrat, was just endorsed by the NRA, and has said, I believe he said that he would be supportive of a bill like that. So I think the argument's going to be really fascinating on the House floor when you have a number of gun control Democrats that are going to support the Democratic statewide governor candidate, but yet go against him on a pretty significant issue. I think in the House, I can really only speak to the House, but I think the House will be fine if it gets there. It's getting through the Senate. That initial conversation in the Senate where it has to start, since it's a Senate bill, they have to override it first and send it to us. I think it's going to be an interesting conversation in the Senate. I think the House will be a much different road there. And I think we'd have the votes to override it.
What do you think, Jay? Is it going to be a rallying point for the chambers?
Well, I don't know if it'll be a rallying point, but I think it's certainly a priority for both chambers. I think the representative is right. I think if it gets over to the House, it's got a pretty clear road. I do think it's going to be tough for the Democratic caucus to come out too strongly against it when they're gubernatorial candidate has at least tacitly supported it, but the question is going to be obviously in the Senate. I've spoken with a handful of senators on the issue. I think they're all committed to doing it. What that looks like is anybody's guess. I mean, we've seen the functioning Senate break down over PQs in the past. I think everybody is interested in avoiding that this year. So the question then becomes what kind of I don't know, what kind of cooperation can we see between the two parties in the Senate to get this done and avoid something like that? I mean, we can't. There's no room for compromise per se. I mean, you can't change the bill at this point in the process. It's just an up or down vote. But I just because there's can't be any traditional compromise, I don't think means that there's can't be any cooperation. So hopefully they can find a way through it. They got a lot of work to do besides the gun bill. They have a short amount of time to do it. So hopefully they can figure their way through it.
Now, Representative, in Jefferson City, a lot of people just say the gun bill and they seem to know what's in it. For our listeners who don't, what is in the gun bill?
I think the most important provision is probably the constitutional carry piece, which would change the law regarding the necessity to have a license to carry concealed. So basically what the bill does is anywhere where you currently have the right to open carry, because we're an open carry state, which means that you can literally have a sidearm on your belt in most places in Missouri, and you can walk around just with it exposed. That's open carry. Anywhere where you can currently open carry, if this bill is overridden, you'll be able to also conceal carry without having to go to your local sheriff and get a license. So I think that's probably in my opinion, the biggest change in this bill. I think that's the one that the governor has had the issue with. That's why he vetoed it. And I also think that, in my opinion, as a Republican, I just trust our citizens to be responsible and to not have to go through all the hoops to be able to conceal carry in places where they're already lawfully allowed to open carry. So I think it's a common sense approach to freeing up their rights, their Second Amendment rights. And that's what kind of stands out to me.
I'd agree with that. I think the representative's right on. I would add to it that the other big flashpoint in the bill is the so-called expansion of the expand your ground doctrine. That received a lot of press nationally a handful of years ago in the Trayvon Martin case in Florida. That was, I don't remember the defendant's name in that case, but his defense that ended up being successful was in fact based on Florida's version of the Stand Your Ground law, which is essentially what we would be passing in Missouri with the if we override this gun bill, which I quite frankly think is good public policy. I don't think you I'm stumbling here looking for my words, but I think it's essentially the same underlying rationale that the representative just outlined, which is we expect that our citizens are law-abiding and that they are responsible enough to handle this type of responsibility, and I think that there's every reason to think that they are. So,
another bill that might come up is voter ID. It sounds like it is going to come up. A lot of Democrats are acting like it's going to be pretty hotly debated. Do you think there's going to be a lot of debate over the voter ID bill, or do you think we're going to see a repeat of last year's incredibly efficient veto session?
I think veto session always seems to last is a lot shorter than people think it's going to be typically. People say it's going to be a couple days. Almost every year it feels like people are saying that, but I think it'll be done in a day this year. And photo ID is not going to take very long in the House, in my opinion. Now, I could be completely wrong about this, but we had 112 votes in the House when they truly agreed, finally passed it. And that was with 11 absentees, I think, from what I recall. So you're talking about something that we can, typically in the House, we shut down debate after a certain period of time. Everybody gets their say over, for the most part, on the issue. And then we kind of move on, we do an up or down vote. And then it'll go, so it starts in the House, and then it'll go back to the Senate. And that's where there'll really be the conversation, I think, will maybe be a little trickier, a little bit longer. But we'll see that, they negotiated out of that early on in the session in the Senate. So hopefully they figure out a way to negotiate it out and just have a vote on it. But that one will be, that one and the gun bill will be really fascinating in the Senate to see what transpires.
And this voter ID bill, is it the partner to the voting measure we'll see in November?
It is.
And so what happens if this isn't overridden and then the voters go to the polls and vote on the HJR that's now an amendment?
Yeah, this gives the, that bill gives the frame, 1631 gives the framework for what that looks like in our state. So it's a necessity to have photo ID in the state for this to be overridden.
So if it's overridden, voter ID.
As long as people vote on it with the HJR.
Okay. And I'm sure there's other bills beyond voter ID and the gun bill that you both want to see. Jay, what do you want to see?
I do. So we have House Bill 1976, one of our lesser known and non-controversial bills that was overridden, or excuse me, vetoed by the governor. It has a handful of different things in it. My interest in that bill is with the towing industry regulations. Those are a product largely of the interim panel on predatory towing from two summers ago that identified, particularly in our urban areas, a number of issues with predatory towing practices and consumers not being able to recover their property when it's been towed. And this bill was Senator Wieland, language that he and his committee came up with following their interim committee on predatory towing practices. It was not vetoed, at least in the veto letter, because of the towing stuff. It was more of a technical veto that has to do with language in the service contract portion of the bill. That is outside of my area of expertise, so I don't know exactly how that operates and what the issue was, but I have spoken with the folks working on that side of the issue, and I'm confident that they have been able to sufficiently educate our members to assuage any concerns there might be over the government's veto, which appears to not have been the correct analysis of how the bill works. So if we can, you know, this bill is one that should be overridden. I think it will be overridden. And if it is not, it is likely not because of any failure in the bill itself. This is one of those situations where we are almost wholly dependent on how the overall veto session shakes out. If some of these other bills we've been talking about, the gun bill, the voter ID bill, if they become more controversial than we would like, if they cause work to get bogged down in either chamber or work to stop in either chamber, then House Bill 1976 and others may very well get caught up in that process and fail to be overridden because the clock runs out and not necessarily because of the merits of the bill. So we hope that doesn't happen. We don't anticipate that happening. Certainly we're working hard, but I think from a consumer protection standpoint, the towing regulations are one of the best pieces of transparency and consumer protection that we passed this year, and I certainly would like to see that overridden. I think that's best for everybody. So,
Representative Fitzwater, what do you want to see?
I think there are two House bills that really stand out that people probably haven't heard a ton about. One is House Bill 1713, which was sponsored by my father-in-law, Rep. Tim Remley from Northern Missouri. It's a bill that basically allows local municipalities to use biological methods to treat their waste plants, which saves them millions and millions of dollars across the state. Right now, what DNR is doing is they're forcing these mechanically engineered wastewater treatment plants onto all these small communities, costing citizens millions and millions and millions of dollars all over the state. And what we want to do is ensure that these city councils, these mayors, these local elected authorities can use methods that aren't going to force huge amounts of tax dollars onto their citizens to change their wastewater systems. There was a provision on the bill that made it controversial and why I believe the governor vetoed it. There was also a Clean Water Commission change, which would require that Clean Water Commission has at least two agriculture folks on the commission, which fired up a lot of people. I think it's a common sense thing myself is for a Clean Water Commission where agriculture is overwhelmingly affected by that commission and its makeup, that it has two people from industry that is probably most impacted by a Clean Water Commission to be on that commission. So I think the bill 1713 is a common sense reform. It's exactly what you want out of your government, protecting citizens and ensuring that they're represented well. And then,
Can I cut you off real quick? Because I think there's an important point here this is kind of down in the weeds type stuff that your average Missourian may or may not be aware of. But our farmers, not just in Missouri, but really across the country, are under fairly constant pressure and attack from the Environmental Protection Agency as they collude with environmental groups on certain issues, primarily clean water. And one of the big issues is what they call in the business non-point source pollution, which is runoff, water shedding runoff from fields into streams and things like that. And that is a constant point of tension and attack for farmers from the regulators, particularly in D.C. and at the state, and to be able to have another voice, have a rural voice on the Clean Water Commission that can help educate other commissioners and help give some backbone to a commission as it needs to protect our farmers and push back on some of the unreasonable regulations that are coming out of D.C. and out of the Department of Natural Resources, I think is hugely important for Missourians. So I'm confident that our guys are going to recognize that and override that bill. So
and the need, it's unfortunate that there's even a need for it, because the Department of Natural Resources could just allow local communities to use biological methods, which are much cheaper than building a whole new mechanical plant to deal with wastewater. And so it's a needed reform. The other one I would highlight is House Bill 2030. It's Representative Denny Hoskins' ESOP bill. It's an employment ownership plan. Basically, it allows current entrepreneurs who have large businesses or any size business to sell shares back to the employees. And when they do that, they're not going to get hit with a huge tax bill because they're selling their company back to the people we want to own. As a state, we want employees to have a vested interest in the companies that they're running. You see these companies that are ESOPs, the employee-owned companies, do as well as any, because when you have employees that are vested in the company, that have ownership over the company, they want to work harder for that company. So we want to build incentives in our state for people, employees, to be entrepreneurs. And this is a way for employees to be entrepreneurs. I actually have a company in my district. He is waiting to sell his company back to employees until this bill passes, so he doesn't get slammed with a tax bill from the state, from the feds, across the board. A really important bill that hasn't got a lot of coverage, but a really good bill.
Why'd the governor veto it?
I think he was worried about the revenue to the state. That's always on a tax, decrease or a tax cut bill like this one, which I think will be highly effective. Democrats, on a typical basis, don't want to lose the revenue that could possibly come into the state. But on the other hand, we want to expand businesses. We want to give incentives. We believe that money in the pockets of our employers and the people in our state is better utilized than money in the pockets of the government. And so I think that's the argument here.
Sure. Now, shifting gears, you've both been around the Capitol for a little while, but Representative, you're entering your second term, and you will be working with some new people next session, for sure. Four of the five executive offices will have new blood. They're all up for election, except for the auditor's office. There was a new poll released yesterday showing Attorney General Chris Coster as the only Democrat up, and Coster has also been the only Democrat endorsed by the NRA. The Missouri Times releasing a new poll today that shows Coster 6 points over Republican nominee Eric Greitens. So our numbers are Coster at 47, Greitens at 41, and then undecided at 6%, the rest going to third and fourth party candidates. So what do you think, Representative? Will Governor Coster be signing any of your bills next year?
That's an interesting comment. But I think Eric Greitens is a type of leader that's inspiring. I've been to a couple of his rallies, and it's nothing like any typical political rally. This is a guy that has inspired people through his books, through the Missions Continues, through his work as a Navy SEAL. I mean, this is an incredible guy. And so there's still time. And I think some of the ads that you would typically see aren't being released yet. In a large election year like this, there's going to be a lot of money being spent, obviously, over the next 2 months. Eric Greitens can raise the money. So I think this is going to tighten as it gets closer. It's going to tighten in a big way. But it will be interesting to see, you know, the Attorney General has gotten the endorsement of the Farm Bureau, all these ag groups, the NRA. It'll be interesting to see if that puts him over the edge and to see if that's the indicator of how the state will move. I think, as Eric mentioned yesterday, these are interest groups that are backing Coster, and Eric's campaign has always been about a grassroots campaign for the people that may not have an interest group representing them. And so I think this is going to be a lot closer than people think, even this far out. The poll numbers, they don't look great. I mean, they're not. It's certainly an uphill battle, but I think Eric has as good a chance as anybody to get over that hill.
Sure. Now, Jay, it seems like you would be happy to work with either if they were governor.
Well, I would. The beauty of my job is that people always talk about crossing the aisle and working with building bridges and working with both sides, and I actually get to do that every day. So I think I've got pretty good relationships on both sides, and I think I could work with either of them. I think the representative is right.
And both of them have experience literally crossing the aisle.
Yeah. Fair, some would say that. I don't know that we have anything documented on at least one of the candidates ever having officially crossed parties. I don't really know. But here's what I can tell you. I've known General Coster for a long time. I worked for him for about 3.5 years. I met Eric for the first time about 2.5 years ago. I was very impressed with him, and I think they're both qualified. Certainly, they both have different resumes. I think either one they both have visions for Missouri that, on the surface, may sound different, but at the end of the day, I don't think are that dissimilar. I think both of them are interested in moving Missouri forward in terms of jobs, in terms of economic growth, in terms of policy that works best for Missourians. So I don't think the people of Missouri lose out either way. That said, it's going to be a tighter race than the polls are reflecting right now. It just will. These things always tighten up the closer we get to elections. Let's not forget that Eric Greitens is the candidate that came in as a complete unknown into a four-way primary and won by double digits. There's something about his message that resonates profoundly with a lot of voters in Missouri. That said, General Koster is a known quantity. He's been around for a long time. He's sharp. He knows the issues. He has built a career, you know, as a moderate, both when he was a Republican and as a Democrat, and he's somebody that both sides feel they can work with, and that's powerful stuff. So, I don't know. What the only thing I know for sure on that race is that it's going to be tight, and we're not going to know till Wednesday morning in November who actually is going to come out on top of that one.
And polling hasn't been this tight on the governor's race since Matt Blunt was in 2008, 2012. The polling was like, it was going to be next to impossible for the Republican to manage the margins they were up against at that point. Different dynamics, obviously, in both of those. In 2008, you have Kenny Holsoff, who didn't really have a chance to get in until late in the game. And then in 2012, you have an incumbent governor that you have to run, against, which was difficult in and of itself. But I think the polling is much closer than it was in those 2 years, and it kind of gives an indication that that there's a chance to get up that hill if the campaign is run well over the next 2 months for Eric Greitens.
Yeah, I would also say that I do think in any normal year, the candidate who got both the Farm Bureau and the NRA endorsements, those are big deals in Missouri, and that would certainly be a decided advantage. But the flip side, and the representative mentioned it earlier, the flip side of that is not getting those endorsements plays right into the narrative that the Greitens campaign has been putting out there all along, and that is, we don't expect our guy to get the endorsement of any insider group, any special interest group, any of the Jefferson City crowd. We don't expect that, and quite frankly, we don't want it because we're coming from the outside. This plays into that, and I think his candidate or his campaign has proven very adept at putting that message out there and putting it out in an effective way, and I don't see any reason to think that they're going to stop doing that over the next couple months. So this is going to get tighter, and it's going to come right down to the line. So we'll see what happens.
And this is a target, a number one target across the nation as a governor's race. The RGA.
You should see the press releases I get every day. It's insane.
This is for the RGA, the Republican Governors Association. I've been told a number of times by a number of individuals they're going to put whatever it takes into this to give Eric Greitens a chance to win it. And that's a big deal. Those are deep pockets. Yeah, so it's going to be a very expensive race.
Yeah, I don't know what the over-under is on the total expenditures for this Missouri's governor's race this cycle, but I'm fairly confident in saying it's going to be the most expensive governor race in the history of Missouri.
Speaking of over-unders, some betting numbers were released. There's betting markets on... on Trump, on everyone, and they're some of my favorite releases to read because people are literally making money for themselves off of betting on elections, just like horse races, and they've got Greitens down as well. But this is actually the first time Koster has really pulled ahead, and it's been since all those endorsements. There's been a lot of aisle crossing endorsements that have been kind of interesting. In other news, there's going to be some changes on the legislative side. Obviously, we've got term limits in this state. And there's going to be a few reps moving on to the Senate, a few reps going home, a few new senators coming in, and there is one senator who's looking to hold on to his seat in the 1st District. We've got Democratic Senator Scott Sifton, who is being opposed by a man named Randy Jott. Sifton's polling at 43%, Jott at 36%, undecided 21%. Now, the 1st District used to be Republican. You think there's any chance that Senator Sifton doesn't come back next year?
I'll field that one first. There's two tight Senate races, and I know we're going to get to Senate 19 in a minute. But of those two, I would anticipate seeing Senator Sifton back next year. I don't know what's going to happen in the Boone County race, but in the 1st District, it's a split district. It switches back and forth, but I think Scott Sifton has done a good job for his district. I think his constituents like him and they know him. And I think that in a tight race, and especially one where he is pulling ahead, not by a wide margin, but certainly he's pulling ahead, I think that the power of incumbency is probably going to carry him through the day, along with, quite frankly, his aptitude for the job. And I would anticipate Senate 1 staying in Democrat hands this cycle.
I think realistically that you would have to say that Senator Sifton as an incumbent has an advantage, but I think Senator Kehoe and Senator Richard are going to put whatever they can into that race outside of what they're already putting into the Rowden-Weber race in Columbia. And they're going to make sure that that one's competitive because they already have invested in it. And they want that seat really bad. I've talked to Senator Kehoe a number of times. They want that seat. I think it's going to be pretty easy to paint Senator Sipton into a corner as far as where he stands on issues. And that's not necessarily a district where you want where it would be a little easier to paint him in that corner when you have a liberal senator and maybe a more moderate in a more moderate district. And Randy Jody is actually a pretty impressive guy. So I think there's a shot there. It's an outside shot. I mean, if we're all realistic, it's an outside shot. But you have enough undecideds there. They can move significantly in one way or the other. And I think there's a way, a significant way to tie Senator Sipton to national politics in a way that I think you can really, really kind of squeeze that margin pretty tight.
Yeah, and I think that's the question too. I think the power of incumbency is probably going to carry the day in that district. But then again, that's also, that's also predicated to some degree on what happens with the national election, the national turnout. And to be honest, I have absolutely no idea. I mean, this is, I think, by any measure, one of the weirdest presidential election cycles we've ever seen, and certainly that I've seen in my lifetime. So I don't know. Everything I'm saying could very easily be out the window based on what the ultimate turnout.
Says the man who had a "Make America Great Again" hat before.
Hey, I'm all in. I've been telling people for well over a year that Trump was going to be the nominee and he's going to be the next president. That's not at all as a popular opinion, but I think there are very strong indicators that would point to that being the result. But the road to get there.
If you knew Jay Atkins personally, though, by the way, too, he's the perfect Trump supporter. I mean, he's like the Trump idyllic Trump supporter. So it's no wonder.
I'm going to take that as a compliment, but I don't know.
It was meant to be a compliment. I appreciate
it. I appreciate it. Well, I tell you what, the guy that's running Trump's Missouri operation. I think one of the brightest guys in the Capitol and one of the guys I have a tremendous amount of respect for, and I think one of the best policy minds in Missouri. Speaking, of course, of Aaron Willard, and I hope he comes back after he gets done winning Trump for Missouri. I hope we get to see him again in the Senate. But all that said, I don't think if anybody tells you they know what the turnout's going to look like and how the electorate's going to break down this cycle, then they're lying to you.
After the primaries, absolutely.
Knows. So
clearly, none of us know what we're doing.
Right, right.
And I think what will be interesting is Trump's numbers in Missouri. So, like, if he wins by a couple points, it's harder for statewide Republicans. It's going to be harder. So if he wins 4 or 5 points against Hillary in this state, it probably drags a little bit on the statewide candidates, or maybe 1 or 2%. If he wins by 10, 12, a dozen points, that makes it a significant difference in the Greitens race. And I don't think as much on the governor's side, but on the down ballot stuff, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, treasurer, attorney general, those races are significantly impacted by a Trump cruising in Missouri. And so I think if you see a 10 or 12% difference in Trump versus Hillary in the state, you see probably all the statewides outside of the governor's, which I think is just a toss-up. There's no telling what that one's going to look like. But the other ones are going to be much more of a down-ballot wave to some extent. So I think those down-ballot guys, are the Democrats especially, are probably hoping for Hillary to overperform in Missouri. She's going to ignore Missouri. And then they're hoping for Trump to set on fire and fall apart here at the end. But
sure.
It'll be interesting.
Of down-ballot toss-ups, District 19, it's basically Boone County. It's got Columbia, but then it has a lot of rural area, too. Formerly Senator Kurt Schaefer's district. Before that, it was Senator Chuck Graham's. It's gone back and forth. We've got two reps, Stephen Weber and reps Caleb Rowden, running. They are currently polling at 45% Weber, 41% Rowden, with 14% undecided.
Yeah.
Obviously, it'll be close.
Yeah.
It's Columbia, but there's other areas, too, which may turn out for Trump.
Yeah, it's that one's neck and neck. And I tell you what, The representative knows both those guys. I've known both those guys for a while, and quite frankly, either one of them make a tremendous senator, and I would be happy to work with either one of them in the Senate. That said, that thing's neck and neck. It's a toss-up. But, you know, I live in the district, so I feel like I have some familiarity with that electorate. And, you know, Stephen Weber is going to win Columbia proper. There's no question about that. He's going to win. He's that kind of candidate. They're both local boys, but, you know, Stephen Weber's, everybody knows him and in Columbia, and I think he's going to do very well. The question is going to come down to turnout in the, you know, outside of Columbia. Once you get out of that, the kind of the urban core of Columbia, and you start looking at some of the northern and southern suburbs, if you will, of Columbia, and then you get out to the more rural areas of the district, it's going to come down to a question of turnout. And if this is a high turnout race, I think the advantage goes to Caleb Rowden if you get a high turnout race. But either way, just like the governor's election, I mean, this one is going to come down to the wire. It's going to be neck and neck. So,
Representative, you were talking about how this is a race the Senate wants. This is a race that they're invested in. Weber actually just crossed the line at $1 million this last week. It's definitely a race to watch. Do you have your pulse? Do you have the pulse on it?
I would agree with Jay to a large extent that it's going to be a toss-up. I mean, it's a turnout. That one's a turnout model, and it just depends on turnout. They're going to spend. Both of them are going to have as many dollars as needed to feel like to get over the line, and it's going to come from a multitude of groups on both sides. I know Senator Kehoe and Senator Richard, their budget includes mainly fighting for a Randy Jody seat and for Caleb to win in Columbia, and most of the funds going to Caleb in Columbia. So you're gonna have some groups, especially it's an interesting one on the right to work piece because the unions can't lose the governor's race. They know that that's the most important one, so they're gonna put most of their resources into that. So I think to some extent, Representative Weber will suffer a little bit from a lot of the union money going to the higher race, the governor's race, because that seat isn't as important as ensuring that there's a Democrat governor for the unions. And in the same way, for Caleb, the national funds, a lot of the right to work funds are going to a governor's race. So I think they're both, to a very small extent, affected by that right to work piece. But it's going to be, like Jay mentioned, I think it's going to be a toss-up. But if you have an election year where Trump wins by double digits, that is a significant advantage for Caleb. And as long as things don't fall apart, I mean, the numbers look good for Trump in Missouri. And I don't think Hillary's going to spend any time here. So I think that's a good sign for Caleb. But, 2 months is a long time in politics and election
years. It is. And I think Representative is exactly right on all that. The one thing I can tell you from living in the district is both of them are working. I've had about three folks from both campaigns walk in my neighborhood, knocking on doors, handing out flyers, and meeting people. So they're both working hard. There's no doubt. And again, I think either one of them would make an outstanding senator. So I work with everybody. I don't have a dog in the fight, but it's going to be fun to watch. And they're both working really hard. So
something I'm looking forward to watching professionally is Caleb Rowden has one of the best get out the vote teams available in Missouri. And I'm really interested to see what they're going to do in Columbia.
Well, they're going to have to work hard in those outlying parts of in the rural parts of the district for sure. And make sure that folks actually get up, go to the polls, cast their vote and do that. So it's a ground game. It's a turnout war. So we'll see what happens.
Well, thank you, Representative Travis Fitzwater and lobbyist Jay Atkins, for joining me at Jefferson City's downtown diner with the world famous Spice. This is Rachel Dunn, managing editor of the Missouri Times, and this has been another hashtag MoLedge podcast brought to you by the St. Louis Regional Chamber of Commerce and the Carpenters Union.